what I knew of Marrakesh was what's on the first wiki page, and that was about it. It was an escape and an opportunity at the same time. All the businesses had recently closed in Sydney, so I was at a quite a low, both sort of professionally and personally. So this was a chance of starting again.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Over the last year and a half, we've spoken to hospitality professionals all over the globe, from the US to London, Copenhagen, Singapore, New Zealand, and many more. The impact of the pandemic has been swift, but different from country to country, and the vaccine rollout is putting some on the front foot to returning to normality. But what is it like in Northern Africa? Andrew Djibe is an Australian restaurateur currently working in Marrakesh, Morocco. Andrew, how are you?
Hi, Huck. I'm well. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, what's it like in Morocco at the moment?
There's a lot of apprehension, I guess. We take out the queues, the health queues come from Europe a fair bit. There's never been any transparency or communication from the government though about what's happening. So it's everyone just waits. We've been in 11 o'clock curfew for the last 18 months, I think. Obligatory mask wearing. It's very tough on a tourist based restaurant. Really tough. So we're just operating on minimal sort of resources at the moment and just getting by.
What sort of impact has it had on the local hospitality industry? You just mentioned that it's really reliant on a lot of tourism. What sort of impact has it had?
I think especially Marrakesh, which is, a real tourist, it exists in its current form really, really through tourism. So it's been devastating, from... and not just the restaurants that have come up from, that have been created from tourism, but you look at Jim Elfner and all the businesses there, the artisanal stall holders, the little food vendors, all of those have been crushed really. There's been lots of protests and sort of strikes and things by the tourist sector. Just obviously the hotels, the food, the transport companies, all of those people are suffering like they are everywhere, I guess. But it's been a very difficult situation. Now it seems that the COVID is going through sort of all the hotel staff as well across a lot of big hotels. So it's been profound and dramatic. Yeah.
Well, your influence on Sydney's restaurant history is prolific over almost two decades. But you weren't always going to get into food. You originally studied law. What made you switch to food?
I think being really shitty at studying is one thing. Finding that hosting dinner parties when I was young, whilst I was still trying to study, was a much more popular way of meeting girls you were much more attractive if you were cooking dinner rather than deep in the books. That got me going. And then pulling on my all of my nonna's recipes and all of that sort of stuff. That's what did it really. And then flunking things, leaving Australia, going to Canada, working in a shitty pizza joint, and coming back to Australia with only that sort of work experience, I guess. So that's what got me into cooking.
When you came back to Australia, you started working at Tattoos when it was back in Rozelle. What was that like, and how did you get that gig?
Yeah, that was a very interesting year. Tet was it was just a job in the paper. I'd had my first cooking job. I was at the Picnic Cafe in Watson's Bay, and there was an ad from Tet's just after a commie, really. And so I applied, and I think he wanted something raw and untrained and with only very basic skills, and that's what he got in me. And then proceeded to well I he didn't train me completely because I think I was untrainable, but he taught me so much. I mean, it was you can chopping two buckets of or julienning two buckets of leeks every day for 12 months certainly hones your knife skills. And he taught me how to taste too, which was, probably the biggest thing. And then a lot of other things, I didn't really appreciate that I'd sort of picked up until later, I think, I was just, I had so little knowledge going into that job that it was a, you know, it was a, it was such a dramatic, opening of, to the full food world, both in from ingredients to quality to, to kitchen systems to everything. So it was a dramatic sort of year to take in. But like I said, it set up for lots of things subsequently, that were the sum of our experiences, I guess.
The first restaurant you opened was Vinny in a small little restaurant in Surry Hills. Tell us about the lead up to that time. How did it come about, and how did you pull it together?
Well, my wife and I had spent ex-wife and I had spent 3 years in Italy, sort of following my following the father's footsteps and kissing the Mother Earth and all that. And so I worked in some restaurants there in Florence and some shitholes in Florence and Rome and then I think it was just that Italian experience of just eating and drinking, just simply and beautifully and that whole ethos. There's no sort of separation of necessarily of wine and food and just the produce just singing on the plate, unadulterated, unfussed. And so that was really the. That just sort of helped crystallize the sort of place that I wanted to have, and it had to be simple. It had, because that was sort of all I could do anyway. But it had to be simple, and it had to be hospitable. It had to be genuine. It had to be affordable too. I mean, that was the other thing that really struck me from just eating in the trattoria and things from especially in Rome. It was just the affordability of everything, the from food to wine to everything. So that's what that actually made it very easy to visualize in terms of sort of place in Sydney. But it took so long to bring together, both from sort of financing to location, then to managing the liquor license, because at that time it was that ridiculous 30% 30% occupancy. You diners only, what was it? Only 30% of your diners could drink without a meal or something absurd like that. And Vini was 20 seats, I think. Plus six outside. So it made it easy to count the seven diners that were drinking. But the whole thing was that, I mean, the point was that, in that Italian sort of mode, everyone should be eating while they're drinking. Like that's just that natural thing. Whether it's antipasti, whether it's just some bruschetta, whatever it is, that they go hand in hand. It wasn't a and so So we would always, we'd give the grissini and the olives and stuff for, if you're having a beer, if you're having whatever. So there'd always be that, it was that sense of, I guess it's European hospitality too. In fact, it's probably worldwide hospitality, except for, traditionally maybe the Anglo-Saxon stuff. I'm not sure. Through lots of sort of hurdles of, the licensing process took so long. But eventually got there, and thankfully, there's been some sense in the last 15 years, and the process isn't necessarily much faster, but the results and the social benefit of some easier licensing things is, I mean, it's been great for the city and the country, I think. I mean, it's, you know, we've grown up a lot in that time. So anyway, Vini was a combination of those experiences, and then I don't know, you learn so much when you open any business, I guess. But suddenly you realize that you thought you were just a cook, but then you have to be a manager as well, which was quite a shock, and sort of managing lives and living other people's lives, that you didn't necessarily ask to do, but you have to. So that was a big shock.
Vinny was a tiny little restaurant, real thriving hub, and a real favorite of lots of people in the hospitality industry as well as consumers. Do you have any stories from the time that you had it that really stand out?
There's, I mean, I guess they're probably familiar stories that sort of anyone in the industry would have of sort of, either some notorious customers that would come in very late and sort of, burn the place up and be wild and untamable. And yet they're sort of your mates, so everything's okay. I mean, with the, I think after 2 years, I think we got that little container room in the back of Vini, which was sort of a little bar area, which became, the natural lock-in place as well. So one got locked in a lot in there, and which was, then you sort of get into the sort of slow spiraling demise of life and health and making prudent decisions and stuff. But yeah, look, just the normal normal hell raising, I think. Coupled with sort of trying to bake your grissini for the next day, after service, and then falling asleep while they're, three quarters of the way through, and having to throw it all out. So yeah, the great thing about Vini was, in its heyday, I mean, it really was a sort of a place for locals as well. That was the core of the place, and being part of a community was really special. And I mean, I lived nearby as well, and so then that was important to me too, that that I understood the area and the, and so, becoming mates with other business owners, the, just being part of that spirit was really, exciting and vital. And then, yeah, eventually, things can get to one's head as well. But it was very, it was, it was wondrously popular. And everything was really simple. The food was very simple and basic. The wines were interesting, but and I think everything was just delivered with sort of some good spirit and soul. And I think that's what probably resonated then.
You mentioned that it was inspired by a trip to Italy, following in your father's footsteps. Is there any dishes that you had on the menu at Vinny you can tell us about that weren't a hat tilt to that heritage that you have?
Yeah, well, my father and grandmother and grandfather, they came from Gorizia, which is just a little town near the border of what's now Slovenia, and so in Friuli. So they're so it's it's northern mountain fare, and Nonna used to make the most sort of ethereally light gnocchi, and so that became a bit of a staple there. She reluctantly but eventually shared her recipe with me. Stood over me whilst whilst we'd make it in the kitchen, and not really let me do anything, just roll things occasionally. But so it was a lot of trial and error. But I think that was the, that was, I mean, the memories of her kitchen were pretty vivid and vital. But yeah, the gnocchi definitely became a staple, and then they popped up in Bacco and over here in Morocco as well. So it's a the gnocchi live on, and it was all about, and to me they sort of represented that, the real homespun food, in that it's the there are measurements, but it's all about touch. It's about, the little details of the temperature of the spuds, of all, how much it's cooked, all that sort of stuff is, the nuances of a very simple process and dish. I mean, I think that's what that's what you're trying to evoke in sort of lots of Italian cooking.
During that time, you became notorious for opening sort of really hideaway sort of establishments like Berta down a little laneway that was impossible to find unless you knew where it was, or 121 BC down that little laneway near where Vinny was. Was that a deliberate thing by you to seek out these establishments that were a bit hidden away?
Deliberate. Not that I. Yes, I suppose so. I mean, to me, well, I mean, the spaces in themselves were generally sort of interesting. I think that wasn't necessarily a great commercial decision. I've got to say, especially on those shitty cold, wet, Sydney nights. But yeah, I think there's just something, interesting about getting to the destination, about being surprised at something being there, and then hopefully that, and then having made a journey that, the place sort of has some spirit, has some identity, because it needs to, because it's not part of a collective or something. So it's, and then it was important too that the venues not be, I mean, they had the same DNA, but they weren't, they weren't cookie cutters of each other, they were very distinct. And I mean, obviously the food at Berta was very much Tama's, and so that was a, that was important too, that it had its, that they all had their own character, I think so. Yeah, so the it was easy to actually look at some of those sites and say, well, that's a great spot for a restaurant. Not so much because it was isolated, but just because they had character, yeah, so that's all.
You had some pretty incredible alumni come out of your kitchens, and you just mentioned Atama Carey, and her influence is amazing now doing Sri Lankan food. What was it like working with her and creating Berta?
Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, she did some pop-ups with Hamish originally, when and I think she just finished it at Billy Kwong, and so they were doing the odd Sunday night at Vini, which was fun. And but working with her, I mean, she's such a you know, a gentle, good soul, you know. So it was, and then she was working sort of casually at Vini, and then the site came up for Berta, and it was a very easy decision to you know, to sort of have a place that Tama could actually do her thing, whilst albeit an Italian thing, but you know, which she took on, you know, wonderfully, as I'm sure you know, and so yeah, working with her was always a joy, actually. I mean, she's just such a good soul, you know.
121BC was really at the forefront in the beginning of the sort of wine venues in Australia and in Sydney. And you guys were really a driving force of that. Some laws changed. Take us back to that time and what it was like trying to create a wine bar in Sydney when the momentum was shifting to allow that to happen.
Yeah, the laws changed, I think. What were the laws? The process was still horrible, but it went through a couple of lawyers before managing that. It was still, and there was always lots of objections, mostly from pubs, I think, local pubs that were just trying to shut down anything that was a wine bar and therefore a perceived threat because it was the great unknown, you know. And so you know, we had 500 objections, I think, to 121BC, you know, which was a 30 seat, you know, 30, you remember, 30, 30 very cramped, you know, little stools in a, you know, in a tiny space. So 500 objections to that. And, you know, they were, they were all real, but they could have been, you know, like, bot generated from the pubs, I think. And so then when we called a meeting of all the objectors and whatever, I mean, I think there was, you know, there were three people on the street that turned up, you know, and then when they realized that, you know, that it wasn't being, that it wasn't going to be a nightclub, this wine bar, it was, because I think at the time there was something in the wording that meant that the two things were grouped. And so, you know, it could be a nightclub or it could be a wine bar or it could be something else. And so therefore, you know, one was associated with the other. So anyway, we mollified the three objectives that showed up, and it was reasonably easy. I mean, we obviously made it harder by throwing in the bottle shop as well. That put everything in a bit of a spin. And then, you know, trying to work out access, and because everything needed to have separate doors and da da da. You know, just because of this incredible way that the thought processes operate in the liquor and gaming department, you know, but anyway, I think the interesting thing is that whenever you're presented with a problem, there's a, you know, there are hopefully ways of, you know, ways of managing it and ways of managing it that, you know, that the customer experience is actually, you know, more interesting perhaps, you know. And so, you know, and obviously it was a thing that you could do in Melbourne very easily. You know, and so we took some cues from, you know, from some of those great places down there, you know, the wine room and stuff. But you know, of being able to buy a bottle and, you know, and have a small corkage on it to drink in the bar, and, you know, obviously now that's pretty commonplace. But you know, I think it's it's sensible, but it's also just interesting for the customer. They've just got more options.
You ended up taking 121BC to Hong Kong as well. How did that come about?
That's a product of a thing called hubris, and there was just a couple of instances close together where some bankers from, you know, who were holidaying in Sydney from Hong Kong came to 121 and pissed in my pocket enough that, you know, and said, "Oh, it's gonna be great in Hong Kong. You should check it out." And so on the way back from Vinitaly 1 year, we stopped in Hong Kong and checked it out. And obviously, it's very, it's intoxicating. It's really beguiling. Any new big city is amazing, right? And so, and Hong Kong especially, because it's got the multicultural tiers, I guess, from both the West and the East. And so it was, we were instantly seduced, and against any decent, business sense or rationale, we sort of went for it, and which is sort of also exciting, and the sort of thing that you shouldn't do after 12 years in the business is to treat it like your first business again. And but in a way, it was only that energy that actually made it happen, because it was ridiculously hard to get finance, to get capital to do it. And I lent on places and people that I shouldn't have, and sort of family and friends, and found local investors too, which was just by selling a great story, which was this natural wine bar thing, and providing a real point of difference to because Hong Kong's obviously it's very showy and glitzy, and we were going in with a very bare bones aesthetic and a very bespoke product, and none of it should have worked, and when we had this pretty shitty space that wasn't much less shitty once we filled it with chairs and tables, but then training local staff and everything was extraordinary. Training customers and stuff, it was ridiculous too. But it's survived for 5 years. I mean, it's still going. It's moved. It's been sold. It's moved. But it was an amazing process. It wasn't good for one's health. Wasn't good for a lot of things. Wasn't good for businesses in Sydney. It was, like I say, it was a function of a lot of ego, and it turned out to be a distraction to stuff that was going on here. So, had some good times though, for whatever that's worth. Not anything that I'll remember, but great, great times and some good people. We brought over sort of most of the team from teams from Sydney. They weren't a team in Sydney, but they were sort of people that had been working in 121 or in Vini. Dan Johnson came and opened it up. Dan was my go-to man for opening just about everything, I think. All those people had a real sense of what the vibe and the what it was we were trying to sell, trying to promote, which was as much a attitude and a philosophy to the actual to the actual food and wine. So it was vital that they came.
How did you end up in Morocco?
Well, part well Cassie Kerensky, who managed Berta for a couple of years, and she's been in Morocco on and off for 15 years, and so we stayed in touch after she left Berta, and she long held this dream to open a restaurant here, and keep saying all the venues here are rubbish, which is still true. The service is appalling, the knowledge of everything is appalling, and so she'd long held this dream of opening a restaurant here, and so finally she got to it, and so she rang me and said, do you know any young chefs that have come over? And I said, oh well, I do actually, and that was me, and to which she said, oh, yeah, thanks, and we'll be talking again soon. And then a month later or something, I messaged him saying, how's it going? Because she should have opened by then or around then. And she just said, can you come? And I said, well, what, just to have a look or to work? And she said, no, to work. And so 2 weeks later, I was on a plane here.
Wow.
What I knew of Marrakesh was what's on the first wiki page, and that was about it. It was an escape and an opportunity at the same time. All the businesses had recently closed in Sydney, so and I'd had a few months working in the kitchen at DSE. Thanks, Nate. Thanks, Matt. But I was at a quite a low, both sort of professionally and personally. There'd been lots of depression and stuff, especially at the closing of Berta. That was quite an incredibly, incredibly low point. So this was a chance of, a chance of sort of starting again and working and having a, just being, not being held back by the recent memories, and also just by the pressures of, the ATO, some unpaid suppliers. Sorry, guys. All of that stuff, which just weighed so heavily. It wasn't an easy decision, though. I mean, my family is obviously still in Sydney. And then this thing hit. So what was supposed to be a 1 to 2 year thing in Morocco, and with hopefully some great things that were supposed to have come out of it, now it's 3 years in a couple of weeks. And obviously no one knows anything anymore, there's a likelihood of a 61 in opening in Casablanca early next year. And so that will be finally the thing that crystallizes, I guess, the reason for coming,
Well, tell us a little bit about Marrakesh. I mean, what do you like about it, and have you, what's it like from a food sense?
I think it's a beautiful city if you can get out of the city a lot. If you can get to the hills nearby, if you can get into the local markets and enjoy that stuff. If you can get away from the tourists, so that's easy right now. Then it's a great place to be. But it's small, it's small. It's really tight. But I think the Moroccan food scene is actually great. It's limiting in that it's culturally very specific, and the lubia or the white beans, they need to be cooked in tomato sauce and cumin. There's no vegetable goes with it. No meat will go with it. They're very, very specific about what can go with what. But within that, there's some wonderful things. The meat cooking, the barbecue game is very, very strong here. On the flip side, the produce is pretty shitty, the range is really minimal. There's been a big organic movement in the last 5 or so years that's changing that slowly. But then there's obviously a lot of Western restaurants, but I think, like I mentioned earlier, they're generally really bad. There's a lot of consultant chefs come in and set up these things, and then as soon as they go, the standards slip. So the alcohol scene's very limited as well, just by sort of what the nature of the supply of things here. So the I'm not going to be selling Marrakesh as a great food and wine destination. So, sorry, Cassie, so yeah, eat local or eat at 61 is my.
You mentioned the stresses of closing your businesses and the move to Morocco. What's the last couple of years been like for you, and has it changed you?
Yeah, it's changed me a lot. I've worked harder in the last couple of years than I had in the preceding 10, I think. Both to, you know, just to show that I could, and it was a new start, and to justify all of that. Really hard coming here with no support in terms of friends and family and everything. So the dislocation has been quite severe, you know. And then the nature of the restaurant industry too is, you know, it's socially cruel, you know, and physically and socially cruel. So, you know, you get bent out of shape very easily at the end of a week or the end of a night, you know. So, none of which really helps your capacity to, you know, to make good relationships or whatever. I mean, but then there's also just that function of time, you know. I think whenever you go somewhere new, you need 2 to 3 years before you start forging decent relationships, before you make proper friends, you know. Like you need that tenure of time to both find yourself, understand the place, understand, you know, and have other people trust you, I suppose, as well with their friendship. So no bones about it. It's been really hard, and I've made a few mistakes. Got bent out of shape a couple of times too often. But, you know, sort of now, weirdly, you know, in this sort of marginalized operating time, you know, generally in a better place. And, you know, and there is this potential business. But yeah, you know, I think everyone's looking over their shoulder, looking at how they can, and pivot both personally or their businesses, and, you know, finding what to do with their new free time. You know, so it's, I mean, some of those things are challenging universally. And then just Marrakesh, has had its specific things, and also just, I think, just dealing with one's baggage, you know.
What are you most looking forward to?
Casablanca, seeing my kids again, you know, that's a big thing. Cause it's been nearly 2 years, I think. So, you know, no amount of video chats and whatever sort of, you know, replaces that. You know, and just the whole time zone thing is actually difficult. You know, even when you're talking to your friends or whatever, I mean, you don't share the same experiences. You're in a different space. There's a, you know, that day versus night thing. You can't really share the same moment, you know. And so it's missing dinners, missing that conviviality of, you know, of socializing and stuff. That's been hard. And just building up, you know, the same sort of thing here of friends and stuff. Cassie has been amazing. My boss and friend. But yeah, you know, it's suddenly you're in a very small bubble. And it's that's challenging, you know, and especially when you're on your own, you know, when that small bubble's not around you, it can be a very lonely and dark place. So learning how to know yourself and manage yourself has been really challenging.
Well, Andrew, hopefully, as the vaccine rolls out, we can all travel again, and you can head on home and see your family. We've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today to hear your story and to get a picture of Morocco as well. Please keep in touch, and we'll catch up again soon.
Huck, thank you so much. Thanks very much. It was great to blabber at you.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au.
Stay safe and be well.